In a sense, both Peter and Judas betrayed Jesus. In what ways were they similar? In what ways were they different? Hello, and welcome to Probe, a weekly program that focuses on a variety of biblical topics. This quarter, our discussion focuses on the Gospel according to Mark. More specifically, this week, we look at Mark chapter 14 on through chapter 15. My name is Paul Dibdahl, and my conversation partners this week are Bruce Johansson, New Testament professor at Walla Walla College and a frequent participant on this program, and also John Dibdahl, a former professor in the Walla Walla College School of Theology who now serves as president of the college. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Paul.
I'll begin with that introductory question again. We have two people who, in a sense, betray Jesus. They don't show faithfulness to him. Both failures are foretold by Jesus. What are some of the similarities between these two, Judas and Peter? And we may also want to look at some ways in which their failures are different.
In a way, I don't want to be overlooking their problems and their difficulties, but it seems to me that you could offer kind of excuses for them if you wanted to in both cases. Judas nowhere says that he doesn't believe that Jesus can do anything. It's just that he evidently wants to make some money and has the wrong concept. And Peter is just, I don't know what you would say, embarrassed about Jesus. That's what you'd have to say, that the people shamed him, and shame in that culture was a very important thing that you wanted to avoid.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of making excuses for them, but the similarities are that neither one of them seemed to have been deliberately malicious in what they did. That would be a similarity. Sin is much more, what should I say, subtle and sneaky than we sometimes give it credit for. A lot of people that do wrong things can find all kinds of reasons for what they do, and at the same time do things that are very, very wrong.
Yeah.
Don't we usually find reasons for even the bad things that we do?
Yeah.
It's a fair guess with Judas after seeing all the miracles that Jesus did, feeding of 5,000, you know, resurrecting from the dead. He thought, I can make money off this. Jesus will, he'll get out of this anyway. It could have been, or else he might have wanted to provoke Jesus somehow to take up the kind of power that Judas was interested in.
Yeah,
I never thought of Peter being embarrassed. I've thought of him probably trying to save his skin, but I think your idea of shame is apropos, John. He was there. This was going in a direction that he never expected. The Messiah that he was going to become powerful through was now on trial, and a sham trial at that. And then somebody started to identify him with this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that's been meaningful to me in the story as well is Peter's willingness in the Garden of Gethsemane when faced with the mob, his willingness to stand up for Jesus, and yet around the fire, questioned by a servant girl, when the pressure, in a way, has eased even, that's the point where he fails. There's a lesson, for me at least, in that.
Well, it could have been, too, that part of that, as Bruce said, and I like what you said, Bruce, that he had expected things to go differently. In the garden, he was on a kingly Messiah, and he thought the sword would work, and the sword didn't work, and things were going downhill fast, and maybe he was starting to say, whoa, I'm about ready to bail out on this one. And it happened. So that would have been a similar. The difference were that Peter's was, whatever we want to say, shame or fear. Whereas Judas was mercenary. He was wanting to make money off of this thing. So their motives were different, but they both led to denial.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the guy who ran off and left his robe behind.
Yeah.
Crisis, we never know how we are going to react to crisis. It's really interesting. Nobody can predict. When a crisis comes, you're going to run scared. Yeah. You're going to deny.
We had best not make strong promises about just how we will behave.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Because we may find that when it actually comes to pass, we were not perhaps as brave, and in some cases we may be braver than we expected.
We need to be very careful about who we vilify and demonize,
because there
may be a good portion of us right in each of those. Yeah. And I think we can find mercenaries and nervous, scared, embarrassed people behind a lot of sins.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jesus is betrayed in the garden. He's arrested. And he goes through what we usually call trials, a series of trials. That word, though, gives the idea of some kind of official, proper kind of legal proceeding. And that really wasn't the case here, was
it? Far from it. First of all, it was illegal to have a trial at night. It was illegal to have a trial that was not taken up before the Sanhedrin. This was in a private home. And then thirdly, you had to let a day go by after. It had to be in the day, and then you had to have another day go by for additional witnesses, if there were any. So this whole thing was just a total sham. It was a setup, is what it was.
Mm. Is anyone frustrated by Jesus' relative silence during the trials when he is asked questions, and now and then he'll respond, maybe briefly, maybe with
very short answers.
Short answers.
Yeah.
Any lesson? I asked if we were frustrated. Maybe a better question is, any lessons that we might learn from this when we are faced with what really amounts to just a bunch of hollow accusations, which are...
Yeah. I think if you know that the trial is a sham, every word you don't say cannot be used against you. I think there's some wisdom in that. Mm. But I think Jesus knew how this was going to turn out, so it was irrelevant to what he would say or not say.
Yeah. There is a choice which Pilate offers to the crowd. He will release either Jesus or Barabbas. Now, I think there's something interesting about this choice, kind of ironic, maybe one way of looking at it. The two seem very different. Well, they are very different, Jesus and Barabbas. But if we look at Barabbas's name, we find, I think, an interesting tie-in with Jesus.
The author could have just said, there was a thief, it's so interesting. These ancients loved, if there was a possibility for a play on words, very often that would come into the story. In fact, it would come in more often than not. And the name Barabbas has some connections.
That's right. Who's going to tell us what those connections?
Son of the father. Bar is in Aramaic for son.
Or son of. Right?
Son of. Mm-hmm. Son of. Like Ben in Hebrew, the same word as Ben in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And Abba is
father.
Father. Daddy. So earlier, as you started to point out here, in the garden, Jesus has prayed to Abba. So he's also son of Abba. And Mark, it's interesting, Mark records that Aramaic Abba.
Yeah.
And then we have Jesus calling out to his father, Abba.
Mm-hmm.
He is the son of Abba in the garden. And now Pilate gives the choice, essentially, which son of Abba do you choose?
That's right. Which son
will
of the father
it be
do you
Barabbas, whose name literally means son of Abba, or is it Jesus, the son of another son of the father?
Yeah.
And it seems to me if we were going to preach a sermon, we could ask a question of ourselves: which Barabbas will we choose? Which son of the father is it that we will choose? A number of characters in the story. We could ask about which characters we identify with most, but we must instead move now to the crucifixion itself. Typically, in our retelling of the crucifixion, we focus on the physical horrors of the cross. And yet, the gospel writers are surprisingly, I think, concise and even colorless in their accounts. What might we learn from this about where we should focus, or maybe where we shouldn't focus when we tell the story of the cross?
We really get caught up in the physical agony of Jesus, don't we? And it was incredible. I think the Romans figured out probably the most excruciating way to put somebody to death. But it was the identity of Jesus that the writers have focused on. The stories over and over again, what was written on the cross, what was confessed by the centurion at the cross. I think those are the things that the writer is more interested in bringing out.
I think one of the reasons for that may be we're not familiar with crucifixions and all they entail, but those people evidently were in a situation where you didn't have to go into a lot of detail because people would understand what was involved.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't so much describing the event as it was showing the significance of Jesus' role in that event and what the meaning was. I don't think I would criticize someone too much who wanted to look at the physical aspects and the description, because we don't have it in our culture and we don't really quite understand what it's about.
That's true.
But they didn't need that
no.
near as much as we need it. And so, again, as Bruce said, the identity of Christ, who he was, how he behaved himself under pressure, I think that's the crux of what they're trying
and
to say.
And then the tragicomedy that's here. He's a king. They dress him in robes. They beat him. They spit on him. Hail, King. The King is on the cross. And that is really the pinnacle of Markan theology. The anti-hero has come to the fullest expression.
How do Jesus' final words here in Mark, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
How do those words?
I just think that we're harking back to the same discussion that we had in the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, if possible, let this cup pass from me. The same incarnate Christ is just saying, this is horrible. You know, my whole life has been built on my connection with the Father, and that seems to be being severed. I can see beyond, but it's by faith, and this sure hurts.
Yeah. Mark's gospel really paints the picture very, very rawly.
This is no plastic Jesus. This is a real Jesus, truly suffering, a Jesus who loves tremendously. Thank you, John and Bruce. And thank you to Susan Michael, our production director. Finally, thank you for listening in. I hope you'll join us again next week. For Probe, I'm Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.